28. White House, Oval Office, Washington, D.C., March 4, 1987, 9 p.m. Ronald Reagan is in trouble. Wearing a dark blue suit and speckled blue tie, the president prepares to speak to the nation. His face is drawn and lined with a red flush. His eyes look just to the left of the camera as he reads off a teleprompter. My fellow Americans, I've spoken to you from this historic office on many occasions and about many things. The power of the presidency is often thought to reside within this Oval Office, yet it doesn't rest here. It rests in you, the American people, and in your trust. Your trust is what gives a president his powers of leadership and his personal strength, and it's what I want to talk to you about this evening. Since January, the president has testified before the Tower Commission twice. Both times he looked confused. During his second appearance, Reagan was so lost that he made the blunder of reading from a top-secret memo when asked what he knew about Iran-Contra. The memo concerned efforts to coach Reagan through the Iran-Contra affair. The media, sensing that Reagan would soon be facing the same fate as Richard Nixon, are now on the attack. Ben Bradley of the Washington Post openly compares Iran-Contra with Watergate. For the past 3 months, I've been silent on the revelations about Iran, the president continues, and you must have been thinking, well, why doesn't he tell us what's happening? He continues, others of you, I guess, were thinking, what's he doing hiding out in the White House? Well, the reason I haven't spoken to you before now is this. You deserve the truth. And as frustrating as the waiting has been, I felt it was improper to come to you with sketchy reports, or possibly even erroneous statements, which would then have to be corrected, creating even more doubt and confusion. Many watching the Reagan broadcast know the president has denied committing any illegal acts, but now he seems to be admitting his denial was false. A few months ago, I told the American people I did not trade arms for hostages. My heart and my best intentions still tell me that's true, but the facts and the evidence tell me it is not. These devastating words do not seem to affect Reagan very much. In fact, a paternal grin now crosses his face. For the first time in his presidency, he is about to admit some level of memory loss. This passage of the speech has been written very carefully. The message coming across is that the problem does not lie with him, but with the people who work for him. One thing still upsetting me, however, is that no one kept proper records of meetings or decisions. He speaks into the camera. This led to my failure to recollect whether I approved an arms shipment before or after the fact. I did approve it. I just can't say specifically when. The speech is Reagan at his paternal best, letting the nation know that he is still in charge and is managing merely a clerical situation. You know, by the time you reach my age, you've made plenty of mistakes. And if you've lived your life properly, so you learn. You put things in perspective. You pull your energies together. You change. You go forward. With that simple statement, Reagan is putting Iran-Contra behind him once and for all. He will move forward. Good night, and God bless you. Ronald Reagan was never held accountable for Iran-Contra. In 1990, he testified behind closed doors to Iran-Contra prosecutor Dan Webb in the federal trial of former National Security Advisor John Poindexter. Reagan's defense was that he could not remember any details of illegalities. Poindexter and Oliver North were among the 13 members of the Reagan administration indicted for Iran-Contra. Both men were found guilty of several felony charges, but their convictions were overturned. Not a single person went to jail for the Iran-Contra conspiracy. 3 weeks later, Ronald Reagan's political soulmate is trying to save her own skin. Margaret Thatcher is in Moscow for meetings with Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev. Thatcher, who is in the midst of a bitter re-election campaign, now sits with Gorbachev in the Kremlin, speaking to him about his recent capitulation to America in reducing his arsenal of nuclear missiles. It is the first time a British prime minister has come to Moscow in more than a decade. Gorbachev has been in power 2 years. He is different from former Soviet leaders, more open to closer relations with America and Britain, simply because he has to be. The Soviet economy has been destroyed by years of military buildup and failed communist economic policies. The Soviet Union is on its knees financially. Only by aligning himself with the West can Gorbachev ensure the viability of his country. Mikhail Gorbachev is a bureaucrat. He worked his way up through the Politburo by holding positions such as Secretary of Agriculture and Chairman of the Standing Commission on Youth Affairs. But his rise through the Soviet system has been an unlikely one, for he was born the son of peasants and once seemed destined to live out his life as a farmer. It was his father who encouraged him to attend Moscow State University, from which Gorbachev graduated cum laude with a law degree in 1955. As he went on to a career in politics, Gorbachev displayed a skill for organization and diplomacy that helped him move from unknown to general secretary within 30 years. Unlike his predecessors, the 56-year-old Gorbachev is not a ruthless killer, nor is he a heavy drinker or womanizer. A balding man with a wine-stained birthmark high on his forehead, he has enjoyed the favor of the Soviet people, who have rallied behind his youth and warmth. Even Ronald Reagan trusts him, believing, "There is a moral dimension in Gorbachev that was lacking in previous Soviet leaders." Gorbachev is trying to find solutions to the problems his country faces. He has not given up on socialism, but he is introducing market reforms and individual freedoms through glasnost and perestroika, openness and restructuring. But even openness has its limits. Gorbachev knows he cannot appear weak before Margaret Thatcher or Ronald Reagan, so the Soviet leader scolds Margaret Thatcher. He is angry that she has referred to his nation as evil, a phrase that Ronald Reagan has also used. Gorbachev thinks this makes him look weak. "No, you can't have thought that," Thatcher answers through her interpreter. Gorbachev and Thatcher each has a small number of advisers witnessing the conversation. "Nobody thinks that the Soviet Union is weak. The Soviet Union has enormous power. You have superior intermediate-range weapons and strategic offensive weapons, if we count warheads, as well as chemical and conventional arms. You are very powerful, not weak." Gorbachev likes her tone. Just like Ronald Reagan, he has tremendous respect for Margaret Thatcher. Despite their ideological differences, he enjoys their verbal jousting. "Once again, I want to emphasize that the most important thing is to remain grounded in reality. Otherwise, we will all be in grave danger," he warns the Prime Minister. She replies, "It is very important for us that you give up the doctrine of communist world domination." "We never proclaimed such a doctrine," Gorbachev says. "There is the Truman Doctrine, the Eisenhower Doctrine, the neo-globalist Reagan Doctrine. All of those doctrines were publicly proclaimed by presidents. But you will not find our statements about planting the domination of communism because they do not exist." 6,000 miles away, Ronald Reagan pays little attention to the verbal duel. He has spent 40 years battling communism and doesn't much care what Mikhail Gorbachev has to say. That's because Ronald Reagan is already forming the words that will stun the world. 2 months after Margaret Thatcher and Mikhail Gorbachev meet in Moscow, she is re-elected prime minister for the third time. On June 8th, Thatcher spends time with President Reagan while both are attending a high-level economic summit in Venice. Both are in agreement that the time is right to strike a blow for freedom and perhaps end communism throughout Europe forever. So it is that Ronald Reagan stands before the Berlin Wall giving the speech that will define his presidency, if not his entire life. The date is June 12, 1987. Reagan is fully recovered from the Iran-Contra affair and is standing in almost the exact same spot where the American general George S. Patton stood 42 years ago. Back then, Patton warned that World War II would never truly be over until the United States defeated the Soviet Union militarily. The world did not listen to Patton. Not only did the Soviets remain in Eastern Europe, but they built a concrete barrier around West Berlin. The so-called Berlin Wall is a symbol of the Cold War. It divides the democratic West Berlin portion of the city from the Soviet-occupied area known as East Berlin. The wall was actually two walls, separated by 160 meters of open ground. This space was mined, contained tripwired machine guns, and was patrolled by guard dogs. Watchtowers overlooked this no man's land, and East German soldiers shot on sight all who tried to escape into West Berlin. In 1963, President John F. Kennedy traveled to Berlin and told the world that the Soviet Union was enslaving people. Now, Ronald Reagan wants to build on Kennedy's historic speech. Flying from Venice to Berlin, Reagan arrived just before noon and traveled by motorcade through the heart of the city to the historic Brandenburg Gate, where a crowd numbering tens of thousands now awaits his words. "People stretching as far as I could see," he will write in his diary. Reagan is theatrical, positioning the Berlin Wall behind him as he stands on an elevated platform. The weather is gray and overcast, with a light wind blowing. Reagan begins his speech at 2 p.m. "Behind me stands a wall that encircles the free sectors of this city, part of a vast system of barriers that divides the entire continent of Europe," Reagan says. "From the Baltic, south, those barriers cut across Germany in a gash of barbed wire, concrete, dog runs, and guard towers. Farther south, there may be no visible, no obvious wall, but there remain armed guards and checkpoints all the same, still a restriction on the right to travel, still an instrument to impose upon ordinary men and women the will of a totalitarian state. At least 80 people have died trying to escape from East Berlin into West Berlin. Communist authorities are ruthless and claim the wall exists to protect people by keeping out subversive capitalist influences." The president continues, "Yet it is here in Berlin where the wall emerges most clearly. Here, cutting across your city, where the news photo and the television screen have imprinted this brutal division of a continent upon the mind of the world. Standing before the Brandenburg Gate, every man is a German, separated from his fellow men. Every man is a Berliner, forced to look upon a scar." The president, like Margaret Thatcher, has enjoyed better relations with Soviet leader Gorbachev in the past year, but Reagan has taken a hard line in arms reduction talks, going so far as to walk out of one summit meeting when Gorbachev's terms of negotiation were not to his liking. The Russians respect toughness, not appeasement, and Reagan knows that backing down will be seen as a sign of weakness. He is not afraid of verbally scorching the communist ideology. In the 1950s, Khrushchev predicted, "We will bury you," Reagan says emphatically. "But in the West today, we see a free world that has achieved a level of prosperity and well-being unprecedented in all human history. In the communist world, we see failure, technological backwardness, declining standards of health, even want of the most basic kind, too little food. Even today, the Soviet Union still cannot feed itself. After these four decades, then, there stands before the entire world one great and inescapable conclusion. Freedom leads to prosperity. Freedom replaces the ancient hatreds among the nations with comity and peace. Freedom is the victor." Ronald Reagan is in complete control. There is no sign of weakness. His voice rises as he drives home his point. He was warned before the speech that by using the wall as a backdrop, his speech would automatically be provocative. But Ronald Reagan wants to be provocative. His message today is so powerful that he will be interrupted 28 times by cheers and applause. Are these the beginnings of profound changes in the Soviet state? Or are they token gestures intended to raise false hopes in the West or to strengthen the Soviet system without changing it? We welcome change and openness, for we believe that freedom and security go together, that the advance of human liberty can only strengthen the cause of world peace. There is one sign the Soviets can make that would be unmistakable, that would advance dramatically the cause of freedom and peace. Reagan pauses, knowing the world is hanging on his words. General Secretary Gorbachev, if you seek peace, if you seek prosperity for the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe, if you seek liberalization, come here to this gate. Mr. Gorbachev, open this gate. Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall. 29. White House Oval Office, Washington, D.C., January 20, 1989, 10 a.m. 2 years after Ronald Reagan demanded the Berlin Wall be dismantled, it is still standing, and time has run out for Ronald Reagan. It is the last day of his presidency. He and Nancy have just said their final goodbyes to the household staff at an emotional gathering in the stateroom. Now, Ronald Reagan takes a final walk along the colonnade to the West Wing and his cherished office. Workers have already cleaned out his files, removing every vestige of the Reagan presidency from the Oval Office, right down to the jar of jelly beans he always keeps within arm's reach. At noon, new President George H.W. Bush will be sworn in at the Capitol. President Reagan rose early, eating a final White House breakfast in the residence with Nancy before getting dressed. At age 78, he is leaving political office for good. But Reagan is not retiring. Concerned about income, he is already planning to supplement his annual presidential pension of $99,500 by making paid speeches around the world. As an orator, Reagan is managed by the Washington Speakers Bureau and earns $50,000 per speech minus a 20% agent commission. In addition to speaking with corporate groups in America, Reagan made $2 million on a 10-day speaking tour of Japan shortly after leaving office. Reagan's last correspondence as president was a parting letter to Margaret Thatcher, reaffirming their deep friendship. She and her husband Dennis visited Washington last month, fittingly making Thatcher the last foreign dignitary to meet with Reagan in the White House. Our partnership has strengthened the ability and the resolve of the Western Alliance to defend itself and the cause of freedom everywhere. Reagan would later write, "You have been an invaluable ally, but more than that, you are a great friend. It has been an honor to work with you." Thanks to the efforts of Reagan and Thatcher, global communism has been severely weakened. Before Reagan's election, it was almost unthinkable that the Soviet Union and its satellite countries in Eastern Europe would embrace democracy, but that process has already begun. Poland is just 5 months away from its first partially free elections since 1928. Emboldened, the people of East Germany will soon rise up and do as Ronald Reagan demanded of Mikhail Gorbachev. 10 months from now, on November 9, 1989, the Berlin Wall will collapse. None of this would have happened without Ronald Reagan's unswerving lifelong belief in freedom and America's exceptionalism. England's Iron Lady understands that. "Your beliefs, your convictions, your faith, shone through everything you did," Thatcher responded to Reagan's letter. "You have been an example and inspiration to us all." Ronald Reagan opens the top drawer of the empty Resolute desk and checks to make sure the workers did not remove a note he placed there yesterday. It is tradition for the outgoing president to leave a simple message for his successor in the Oval Office. Reagan's handwritten letter wishes Bush good luck and reminds the new president that he will be in his prayers. Despite the warm tone, there is tension between Reagan and Bush, stemming from the campaign. Ronald Reagan endorsed the candidacy of his former vice president, but did very little campaigning on his behalf. Some believe Reagan was snubbing Bush, but the truth is, the Bush campaign wanted the candidate to be his own man. A barnstorming Ronald Reagan could easily have overshadowed the less charismatic Bush. The residence has become a beloved home to Ronald and Nancy. Reagan is a sentimental man, and very much moved by the sense of history filling that space. The president is convinced that the ghost of Abraham Lincoln haunts the residence. He has stated that he can sometimes hear the creak of Franklin Roosevelt's wheelchair gliding from one room to another, and he once told a friend he could easily imagine the ghost of Teddy Roosevelt mumbling his trademark cheer of, "Bully!" "We were familiar with every room and hallway," Reagan will later write, "and had the warmest memories of our life in that beautiful historic mansion. But now it is time to go." National Security Advisor Colin Powell steps into the office to give Reagan his last ever daily briefing. "The world is quiet today, Mr. President," the former Army general says succinctly. Reagan reaches into the jacket pocket of his crisp blue suit. He pulls out the plastic card he has carried with him every day since taking office. It authenticates that he is President of the United States. In the event of a nuclear war, he will present this to the military attaché who remains near him at all times, whereupon the special briefcase known as the football will be opened and the nuclear launch codes revealed. "What do I do with this?" he asks Powell. "Hang on to it," Powell replies. "You're still president." Ronald Reagan's last official act as President of the United States takes place just before 11 a.m., as he hands the plastic authentication card to his Air Force military aide. Now, at 12:40 on a bitter cold Washington day, with George Bush already sworn in as the 41st President of the United States, Ron and Nancy Reagan step aboard a government helicopter to begin the journey back to California. As he is no longer president, the call name Marine One no longer applies to the official aircraft. It is Nighthawk One that lifts off from the Capitol, taking the couple to Andrews Air Force Base. The moment, in Nancy's words, is wrenching. They have participated in a long list of final scenes in the past few weeks: final visit to Camp David, final dinner in the White House, and final moment with the press. This morning at their goodbye reception is when it hit Nancy the hardest that it was over. "We were supposed to have coffee, but I don't remember drinking any. Then it was time to leave for the inauguration," she will later write. As she and Barbara Bush share a limousine to the swearing-in, Nancy gazes out the window at the White House lawn, wondering if the magnolia trees she planted will survive long enough for her grandchildren to see them. "My heart ached as I looked at those beautiful grounds I was unlikely to see again." Time and events have changed Nancy Reagan. Shortly after her return from Berlin in 1987, the First Lady was diagnosed with breast cancer and underwent a mastectomy to remove one breast. The procedure was a success, and Nancy's very public ordeal softened her in the eyes of many. With the end of her husband's presidency, whatever animosity may have existed between the Reagans and the media has now been replaced by nostalgic warmth. Walter Cronkite brought the Reagans on stage for a round of applause at the recent Kennedy Center honors, leading the orchestra in a chorus of Auld Lang Syne. And even Sam Donaldson, the ABC newsman who has been baiting the Reagans for 8 years, approached Nancy recently to say that he would miss them. As the helicopter lifts off, the Reagans take one last look at the White House. They push their faces against the windows, straining to see the glory of their former home. Below them sprawl the vast lawns, fountains, and famous columns they have come to know so well. Even as they look down, movers are hauling their furniture into trucks for transport back to their new home in Beverly Hills. The Bush family furniture, meanwhile, is being installed in its place. "Look, honey," says Reagan, not taking his eyes off the White House. "There's our little shack." The pilot finally banks away, steering the VH-60N helicopter to Andrews. the Reagans, vanishing into the clouds. 30. Mayo Clinic, Rochester, Minnesota, September 8, 1989, 11 a.m. 8 months later, the White House is the last thing on Ronald Reagan's mind. A surgical drill hums as the former president lies flat on his back in an operating room. 59-year-old brain surgeon Dr. Thorolf Sundt presses the bit against the right side of Reagan's skull and carefully opens a hole the size of a nickel in his cranium. 2 months ago, Reagan was thrown from a horse while riding at a friend's ranch in Mexico, just south of the Arizona border. The horses used during the ride were unshod and left to run wild when not saddled, leading Secret Service agent John Barletta to warn Reagan against the ride. Nancy took the advice, but the former president did not. On the second day at the ranch, Reagan's horse was spooked by a wild bull. It began bucking wildly. At first, Reagan was able to hang on, but the frightened horse continued kicking its hind legs straight up into the air, and on the third buck, Reagan was hurled from the saddle. He flew so high that his entire body rose above the heads of those riding alongside him. Reagan landed hard, slamming his head into the rocky soil, just missing a patch of cactus. "Rawhide down!" Agent Barletta yelled into his radio, marking the first time those words had been uttered since the assassination attempt of 8 years earlier. Reagan lay unconscious, but soon revived. At first, he appeared uninjured. Nevertheless, he was flown by military helicopter to an army hospital in Arizona, where he was treated for scrapes and bruises, then brought back to the ranch to continue the vacation, albeit without any further horseback rides. But unbeknownst to Reagan and his doctors, a blood vessel in his head ruptured during the fall. For 2 months, fluid has been leaking into his skull, causing a clot that is slowly putting pressure on Reagan's brain. This condition, known as a subdural hematoma, alters mood and vision and elevates levels of dementia. Patients often complain of headaches or simply fall into a stupor before seeking treatment. But Reagan's hematoma is a silent killer, with no outward symptoms other than his usual forgetfulness. Were it not for his annual physical here at the Mayo Clinic, the former president's condition might never have been discovered. But a precautionary CAT scan located the clot, and Reagan was rushed into surgery. Dr. Sundt removes the drill, then looks through the opening at Reagan's brain. In the course of his job, the esteemed surgeon glimpses the human brain on an almost daily basis. But this is the brain of a living president. Dr. Sundt has the unique opportunity to save Reagan's life. Clinically, the procedure Reagan is undergoing is known as a burr. In many cases, it is necessary to drill a second and even third hole to ease the pressure, but the brain surgeon is satisfied that one burr is enough for Reagan. And that, seemingly, is that. Less than an hour after being sedated, Ronald Reagan is wheeled into the recovery room. His doctors are satisfied that Reagan shows no signs of the stroke, nerve damage, or paralysis so common in elderly patients suffering from head trauma. But the truth is that despite the operation, the fall has accelerated Reagan's debilitating condition. Nancy Reagan will one day sum it up best. "I've always had the feeling that the severe blow to his head in 1989 hastened the onset of Ronnie's Alzheimer's." 4 years later, Ronald Reagan is still functioning. The date is February 6, 1993, and the occasion is Reagan's 82nd birthday. Reagan and Margaret Thatcher chat amiably about their lives since leaving office. Unlike Reagan, Thatcher did not go of her own accord. She was forced out by her own conservative party in 1990 and cried as she left 10 Downing Street for the last time. Now at age 67, she makes her living giving speeches at $50,000 per appearance and works on her memoirs. The state of dementia in which she will spend her twilight years is still almost a decade away, and she is sharp as she stands next to Reagan in the Oval Office. The birthday fundraiser is not at the White House, but in Simi Valley, California. Tonight, Reagan and Thatcher are standing in the exact replica of the Oval Office now on display here at the Ronald Reagan Presidential Library. Thatcher and a host of celebrities have gathered for this $500 per plate dinner to raise money for the library. Old Hollywood friends Jimmy Stewart and Merv Griffin and media mogul Rupert Murdoch are among the 500 guests at the Black Tie Affair. The festive night sold out immediately. Reagan and Thatcher move into the great white tent pitched on the library lawn where dinner will be served. The menu is crab-stuffed fillet of sole, prime rib, and baby potatoes, all washed down with the California wines Ronald Reagan has long enjoyed. Dessert will be another longtime Reagan favorite, Haagen-Dazs ice cream topped with fudge sauce. The night belongs to Ronald Reagan, and it is Margaret Thatcher who rises first to pay homage. She praises him for bringing the evil empire crashing down. "If Ronald Reagan's birthday is celebrated warmly in California," continues Thatcher, "it is celebrated even more warmly in Prague, Warsaw, Budapest, and Moscow itself." Then it's Reagan's turn to toast Thatcher. "Thank you, Margaret, for those very kind words," he begins. Reagan's toast continues at length. He wrote and memorized it beforehand. On paper, the speech fills 4 typewritten pages. "I don't think I really deserve such a fuss for my birthday, but as George Burns once said, I have arthritis, and I don't deserve that either," he says with a smile. Reagan continues, "Margaret, you have always been a staunch ally and a very dear friend. For all of us, I say thank you for the immense role you have played in shaping a better world, and I personally thank you for the honor of your presence tonight." As he finishes, the entire tent thunders with roars of "hear, hear," and the clinking of glasses. Moments later, Reagan stands to deliver a second toast. Anticipation grows as the former president stands erect, his blue eyes shining, his tuxedo perfectly fitted to his body, which looks a decade younger than his actual age of 82. To the casual observer, Ronald Reagan appears to be fit and healthy. Slowly he turns to Margaret Thatcher and raises his glass once again. Mrs. Thatcher is beaming, and the audience eagerly awaits Reagan's next memorable line. Smiling, he begins to speak. "Thank you, Margaret, for those very kind words," he says, raising his glass. "I don't think I really deserve such a fuss for my birthday, but as George Burns once said, I have arthritis, and I don't deserve that either," Reagan says with a chuckle. Immediately, shock envelops the room as Ronald Reagan, word for word, delivers the same exact 4-page toast to Margaret Thatcher that he uttered just a few moments ago. Reagan continues for 2 excruciating minutes. "And I personally thank you for the honor of your presence here tonight," the former president tells Margaret Thatcher, raising his glass once again. Reagan's friends sit in stunned silence. 31. Los Angeles, California, June 1994, morning. The man with 10 years to live has been dealt a stunning blow. His daughter, 41-year-old Patty Davis, is now fully exposed for the entire country to see. Playboy magazine is on newsstands everywhere, its cover promising a father's ultimate humiliation. Patty wears nothing but a smile as the hands of a muscular, unseen man cup her bare breasts. The magazine's lurid headline promises that Ronald Reagan's renegade daughter will tell all. As Patty Davis has intended, her father is deeply wounded by his estranged daughter's latest attempt to embarrass him. For years, Reagan has struggled to deal with his rebellious children. But Patty has always been the biggest problem. From her defiant liberal politics to her open use of marijuana, she has striven to be the polar opposite of Ronald and Nancy Reagan in every way. Just 2 years ago, Patty published a tell-all memoir about life in the dysfunctional Reagan family. The book revealed Nancy's dependence on tranquilizers and diuretics, along with the fact that Patty was so afraid of becoming pregnant and parenting as her mother had that she had herself rendered infertile with a tubal ligation at the age of 24. In addition, Patty openly led a lifestyle that flaunted a libertine attitude on social issues. One writer described her as an angry daughter with scores still to settle. Now, grinning on the cover of Playboy, she has humiliated her mother and father, and the whole world knows it. Patty Davis publicly states that her rebellion is Nancy's fault, saying that her mother was physically and emotionally abusive, a chronic prescription drug user who slapped her daughter when she ate too much, and even slapped her when she began menstruating at a very young age. When she told her father about the abuse, Davis alleged, Ronald Reagan called her a liar. "Patty, you are hurting us, your parents, but you are hurting yourself even more," Reagan wrote to his daughter in 1991 when word leaked that she was writing her tell-all memoir. "We are not a dysfunctional family," Reagan's letter continues. "Patty, in our meeting at the office, you said your mother didn't like you. That's not true. Yes, she's unhappy about the way things are, but again, I can show you photos in which the love between you is unmistakable, and these pictures are at almost every stage of your life. Pictures don't lie." Reagan concludes, "Please, Patty, don't take away our memories of a daughter we truly love and who we miss. With love, Dad." But Patty Davis did not listen, and her defiance is clear in each and every photo in Playboy. She looks straight into the camera, knowing that every click of the photographer's shutter publicly will humiliate the man whom she considers a failure as a father. It is a stunning betrayal. 2 months earlier, Ronald Reagan experienced another episode of public embarrassment. The date is April 27, 1994. Ronald and Nancy Reagan are attending the funeral of Richard Nixon. 20 years after the Watergate scandal brought him down, and less than a year after his beloved wife Pat succumbed to lung cancer, the 37th President of the United States is dead of a stroke at the age of 81. Nixon is being laid to rest on the grounds of his birthplace and presidential library in Yorba Linda, California. Despite hitting afternoon traffic on the drive south from Beverly Hills, it takes the Reagans just a little over an hour to arrive for the 4 p.m. ceremony. There are four former presidents and the current chief executive, Bill Clinton, at the funeral. In addition, a crowd of 4,000 sits in folding chairs awaiting the start of the ceremony. Among the last to be seated are the former presidents and their wives. There is no formal introduction, but as a Marine Corps band plays light, triumphal music, each couple walks to their seats to polite applause. Gerald and Betty Ford, Jimmy and Rosalind Carter, George and Barbara Bush, and President Clinton and wife Hillary all take their seats. But it is the arrival of Ronald and Nancy Reagan that steals the show. As the television audience and those in attendance look on, Reagan's confusion is apparent. Making their way down the steps after Ford and before Carter, the former president holds tight to Nancy's hand. She leads him like a child, walking in front and pulling him along. Reagan looks bewildered and frequently swivels his head. He wears a fascinated smile, as if not sure what all the hoopla is about. As the audience breaks into applause, Nancy whispers to her husband, telling him to wave to the crowd. He dutifully obliges. As the Reagans take their seats between the Carters and Bushes, Ronald Reagan's physical decline is clear as well. Compared to Gerald Ford, who at age 80 is just 2.5 years younger, Reagan looks frail and wrinkled. Ford thinks he looks hollowed out, and Bush is telling friends that he is deeply worried about Reagan. Carter, for his part, thinks that Reagan's responses to everyday questions are not right. But even as these former presidents are well aware of Reagan's decline, there is a general consensus among the media that the matter must be kept hushed until the Reagan family chooses to make it public. Nixon's funeral is Ronald Reagan's last major appearance. After a lifetime of performing, the actor has now left the stage. 4 months after the Nixon funeral, Ronald Reagan is back at the Mayo Clinic for his annual physical. It is August 1994. Southern Minnesota is humid and hot this time of year, but it is cool and comfortable in the small examination room in which Ronald Reagan now sits. His hair is turning silver in a show of his advanced age. As he does every year, the former president is having his blood pressure checked as a doctor listens to his heart. But at Nancy Reagan's behest, the esteemed physicians of the Mayo Clinic are also conducting a different sort of test today. "What did you have for breakfast?" Ronald Reagan is asked. It is a simple question, something anyone with a memory could answer immediately. Reagan stammers. He smiles as he racks his brain. He does not know what he had for breakfast. In fact, it is not clear if he knows what breakfast is. The doctors take notes. The truth is, the former president is now totally dependent on Nancy. Reagan has begun asking Nancy questions such as, "What do I do next?" and observing aloud, "I'm not sure where I am." He no longer recognizes old friends. Nancy Reagan listens in on his phone calls to prompt him when he experiences memory failure. When asked by Time magazine journalist Hugh Seide about Watergate shortly after Richard Nixon's death, Reagan cannot even recall the scandal. "Forgive me," Reagan finally admitted to Seide, "but at my age, my memory is just not as good as it used to be." Now at the Mayo Clinic, Reagan fails to answer the breakfast question. He also cannot recite a short three-item list after it is presented to him. The situation is clear. "Over the past 12 months, we began to notice from President Reagan's test results symptoms indicating the possibility of early-stage Alzheimer's disease," reads the diagnosis. "Additional testing and an extensive observation over the past few weeks have led us to conclude that President Reagan is entering the early stages of this disease. Although his health is otherwise good, it is expected that as the years go on, it will begin to deteriorate. Unfortunately, at this time, there is no cure for Alzheimer's disease, and no effective treatment exists that arrests its progression." 3 months after his Mayo Clinic physical, Ronald Reagan joins past presidents and first ladies who have made public their health woes. It was Franklin Roosevelt whose frank admission about polio in 1938 launched the charity known as the March of Dimes. Betty Ford's honesty about her breast cancer and her later battle with alcoholism helped make those two emotional topics open for public discussion. Now, despite his growing confusion and forgetfulness, Ronald Reagan is still alert enough to be aware of the fate that has befallen him. On good days, he understands he is helpless to stop the advance of Alzheimer's. The disease is fatal, killing its victims in 4 to 12 years. The only drug currently on the market, Tacrine, is not a cure, but a stopgap to improve memory temporarily. The world is still learning about Alzheimer's. They lump it together with terms such as senility and dementia. The date is November 5, 1994, as Ronald Reagan takes pen to paper to tell the world. "My fellow Americans, I have recently been told that I am one of the millions of Americans who will be afflicted with Alzheimer's disease. Upon learning this news, Nancy and I had to decide whether, as private citizens, we keep this a private matter, or whether we would make this news known in a public way. In the past, Nancy suffered from breast cancer and I had my cancer surgeries. We found, through our open disclosures, we were able to raise public awareness. We were happy that as a result, many more people underwent testing. They were treated in early stages and able to return to normal, healthy lives. So now, we feel it is important to share it with you. In opening our hearts, we hope this might promote greater awareness of this condition. Perhaps it will encourage a clearer understanding of the individuals and families who are affected by it. At the moment, I feel just fine. I intend to live the remainder of the years God gives me on this earth, doing the things I have always done. I will continue to share life's journey with my beloved Nancy and my family. I plan to enjoy the great outdoors and stay in touch with my friends and supporters. Unfortunately, as Alzheimer's disease progresses, the family often bears a heavy burden. I only wish there was some way I could spare Nancy from this painful experience. When the time comes, I am confident that with your help, she will face it with faith and courage. In closing, let me thank you, the American people, for giving me the great honor of allowing me to serve as your president. When the Lord calls me home, whenever that may be, I will leave with the greatest love for this country of ours and eternal optimism for its future. I now begin the journey that will lead me into the sunset of my life. I know that for America, there will always be a bright dawn ahead. Thank you, my friends. May God always bless you. Sincerely, Ronald Reagan. With his fate sealed, Ronald Reagan sits in a pew at the Bel Air Presbyterian Church. A tall wooden cross rises from behind the pulpit as Senior Pastor Michael Wenning leads the congregation in the Lord's Prayer. "Our Father," says Reagan, in words he memorized as a child. He fixes his eyes on the cross. "Who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name." Next to Reagan sits Nancy, who also prays aloud. And next to Nancy is Patty Davis. After years of bitter isolation and estrangement, Ronald Reagan's Alzheimer's diagnosis has finally brought his daughter back. Incredibly, she is about to move home, mending a lifetime of wounds to be near her father in his last days. Patty Davis's turnaround is amazing. Like her siblings, she has set aside the past. Gone are the days of angrily mocking her father's politics. Her aim is now reconciliation instead of rebellion. Amen. It is a February afternoon in 1996, a day of cool sunshine and clear skies in Southern California. George Shultz sips tea with Ronald and Nancy Reagan at their Bel Air home. The azaleas along the driveway are just beginning to bloom. The former Secretary of State has come to say hello to his former boss, a man whom he served for 6.5 years. Together, they spent countless hours crafting the foreign policy that would come to define the Reagan administration, ending the Cold War and bringing an end to communist influence around the world. They traveled together aboard Air Force One and sat together at the bargaining table as Reagan coolly negotiated a new arms treaty with Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev. But Ronald Reagan remembers none of that. He has even begun to forget that he was once President of the United States. And although he keeps regular hours at his nearby office in Century City, his time is spent mostly reading the comics and sitting in the nearby Arm & Hammer Park watching children at play. On the outside, Reagan still looks healthy. On the inside, he is dying. Sometimes Reagan wakes up in the middle of the night thinking it is time for breakfast. He can still dress himself, sometimes tying a neat Windsor knot. His handshake is still firm. And when he ventures out to the Los Angeles Country Club to play golf, he is very much like other golfers on the course, exulting in good shots and swearing angrily when his drives go astray. But Reagan's round is limited to 1 or 2 holes instead of 18. Perhaps the most telling sign that the end is near is that Reagan's beloved Rancho del Cielo is for sale. No longer able to ride a horse or clear brush, Reagan never goes to the ranch. It is now up for sale to the highest bidder. Of this, Ronald Reagan has no idea. As George Shultz and Nancy Reagan continue to visit on this warm winter afternoon, Reagan finally stands and leaves the room, followed by a nurse. "Who is that man sitting on the couch with Nancy?" the former president asks the nurse. "I know him. He is a very famous man." 32. St. John's Health Center, Santa Monica, California, January 20, 2001, 9:05 a.m. Nancy Reagan sits in a chair next to her husband's hospital bed, watching a new president being sworn in. "I, George Walker Bush, do solemnly swear..." Ronald Reagan also watches the ceremony, completely unaware that he took the same oath 20 years ago today. There is a faraway look in his eyes as he gazes at the television. It is now 7 years since the Alzheimer's diagnosis. Reagan will turn 90 in 2 weeks. 8 days ago, he broke his hip in a fall at home, and upon his release from the hospital, he will be bedridden for the rest of his life. The former president's rugged physique has grown frail, his daily workouts a thing of the past. His once broad shoulders are shrunken. The bones in his back are clearly visible, pressing through his thin flesh. But Ronald Reagan is unaware of his physical condition. He also does not even recognize his own wife. "My mother speaks of the loneliness of her life now," daughter Patty writes in her journal. "He's here, but in so many ways he's not. She feels the loneliness in small ways. He used to put lotion on her back. Now he doesn't. And in the huge, overwhelming ways, a future that will be spent missing him." Nancy knows that her unswerving devotion to her husband made her a target of scorn in their White House days, and for that she makes no apologies. "I'm the one who knows him best, and I was the only person in the White House who had absolutely no agenda of her own, except helping him," she stated in her autobiography. The Reagan's good friend Jimmy Stewart once noted that if Nancy had been Ron's first wife instead of his second, he would have been a real star in Hollywood with a couple Oscars to show for it. Instead, Nancy guided him to the presidency. "As much as I love Ronnie," she writes, "I'll admit he does have at least one fault. He can be naive about the people around him. Ronnie only tends to think well of people. While that's a fine quality in a friend, it can get you into trouble in politics." In this way, Nancy Reagan had a hand in changing the world. Now, as she and Ronnie watch the presidential inauguration just hours before Reagan will be released from the hospital, her commitment to him continues. Since the fall, he never leaves the house anymore, other than on those occasions when he is placed in a wheelchair and rolled outside to the patio. "My father is the only man in the house these days, except for members of his Secret Service detail who occasionally come in," Patty Davis will write. "It's a house of women now. The nurses, my mother, the housekeepers." It is a tedious life for Nancy. She remains at her husband's side night and day, leaving only occasionally to have a Cobb salad and chocolate chip cookies with friends at the nearby Hotel Bel Air. The relief is needed, because Ronald Reagan can no longer do anything for himself. His home office has been turned into a bedroom. There, next to the desk on which he once wrote so many letters and speeches, he spends his days on a hospital bed tended by his staff and Nancy. He cannot feed himself or even speak. He is simply waiting to die. "I christen thee United States ship Ronald Reagan, and God bless all those who sail on her," says Nancy Reagan on March 4, 2001, standing before a crowd of thousands in Newport News, Virginia. She swings the traditional bottle of champagne, shattering it against the ship's steel hull. Nancy smiles as the audience of naval personnel and dockyard employees breaks into applause. Her husband would love knowing that a nuclear-powered aircraft carrier is being commissioned in his honor. On this day, she and Ronald have been married 49 years, but Ronald Reagan does not know this as he lies almost still day after day in California. "It's lonely," Nancy will tell Mike Wallace in a rare televised interview for 60 Minutes. "When you come right down to it, you're in it alone, and there's nothing that anybody can do for you." So it is that 1 year after the USS Ronald Reagan is launched, the Reagan's landmark 50th wedding anniversary comes and goes without fanfare. "There were times I had to catch myself," Nancy will recall of March 4, 2002, "because I'd reach out and start to say, 'Honey, remember when—'" 2 years later, it is clear that Nancy Reagan's lonely vigil will soon come to an end. Ronald Reagan, asleep, is struggling to breathe, unaware that his daughter Patty sits atop his old desk, watching him slip away. Ron Jr. has cut short a Hawaiian vacation and is on his way to California. "We are witnesses to the end of a life," Patty will write, "and even though we have known this is coming for years, it feels as if we have never considered it as a reality." But Nancy Reagan will not say goodbye to her husband. Throughout his decade of decline, she has tended to him as if he were still sound of body and mind. Nancy still sleeps in their bed, keeping as many traditions alive as possible. From the day they met in 1949, she made it her mission to marry Ronald Reagan and then mold him into the man she thought he could be. She has endured years of scathing attacks, all because of her loyalty to her husband. Even now, in the midst of what doctors are calling continual neurological degradation, Nancy protects the former president. No outsiders are allowed to see him, other than family. Right to the end, she is managing the legacy of Ronald Reagan, even as she struggles to imagine life without him. "He's there," she once told an interviewer, explaining why she could not say goodbye to this man with whom she'd shared a wondrous lifelong journey. "He's there." 2 days later, on June 5, 2004, a sobbing Nancy finally acknowledges the reality. Ronald Reagan is gone. 33. National Cathedral, Washington, D.C., June 11, 2004, noon. The whole world is watching. "We have lost a great president, a great American, and a great man. And I have lost a dear friend," says Margaret Thatcher, her face appearing on the big-screen monitors arrayed throughout the cathedral. "In his lifetime, Ronald Reagan was such a cheerful and invigorating presence that it was easy to forget what daunting historic tasks he set himself." Nearly 4,000 mourners fill this century-old Episcopal church, watching as Thatcher praises her dear friend on videotape. Among the crowd are the Reagan family, President George W. Bush, and former Presidents Ford, Carter, Bush, and Clinton. Thatcher herself is in attendance, dressed all in black with an enormous hat, seated up front next to Mikhail Gorbachev. She is frail and hunched, her doctors having ordered her not to travel. Thatcher has ignored them out of respect for her longtime friend. However, fearing that she might embarrass herself by speaking live at the service, Baroness Thatcher videotaped her anticipated eulogy for Reagan months ago in London. But not everyone is giving tribute. In communist Cuba, the government greets Reagan's death with a proclamation attacking his conservative policies, stating, "He should never have been born." And in America, the far left's opinion of Reagan's passing is summarized in Slate magazine. "He was as dumb as a stump," writes Christopher Hitchens. "I could not believe that such a man had ever been a poor governor of California in a bad year, let alone that such a smart country would put up with such an obvious phony and loon." Reagan's funeral is the largest in America since that of President John F. Kennedy more than 40 years ago. Security is extremely tight, as this is the first major national event since the September 11, 2001 terrorist attacks on New York City and Washington, D.C. But once Reagan's body rests inside the Capitol Rotunda and the doors are open to the public on the evening of June 9th, a wave of humanity arrives to pay their respects. Many have been waiting 2 days for this opportunity. All through the night and the next day, 5,000 visitors per hour walk past the casket of Ronald Reagan. On the morning of June 11th, which President George W. Bush has declared a national day of mourning, the body of Ronald Reagan is delivered to the National Cathedral for the first state funeral since that of Lyndon Johnson in 1973. With a global television audience looking on and 3,700 mourners in the pews, Margaret Thatcher's taped eulogy concludes. "Ronald Reagan's life was rich not only in public achievement, but also in private happiness. Indeed, his public achievements were rooted in his private happiness. The great turning point of his life was his meeting and marriage with Nancy. On that, we have the plain testimony of a loving and grateful husband. Nancy came along and saved my soul." Television cameras and all within view turn to Nancy. Despite the 10 long years of Reagan's decline and the ample time she has had to prepare for this moment, she is consumed by grief. "We share her grief today," Thatcher continues. For the final years of his life, Ronnie's mind was clouded by illness. That cloud has now lifted. He is himself again, more himself than at any time on this earth, for we may be sure that the big fellow upstairs never forgets those who remember him. And as the last journey of this faithful pilgrim took him beyond the sunset, and as heaven's morning broke, I like to think, in the words of John Bunyan, that all the trumpets sounded on the other side. A subtle smile creases Thatcher's lips on the screen as she ends her eulogy. As she does so, it is possible to see the slight facial paralysis from her recent series of strokes, and yet her voice is clear and deliberate. We here still move in twilight, but we have one beacon to guide us that Ronald Reagan never had. We have his example. That evening, the body of Ronald Reagan is buried in California. Margaret Thatcher is there. So is Jane Wyman. Nancy Reagan kisses the coffin and whispers, "I love you," before stepping away for good. Nancy, clutching the American flag that once draped her husband's coffin, dissolves in tears. She looks pale, fragile, and frightened. Four F-18 fighter jets thunder overhead while a military band plays "America the Beautiful." Symbolically, one of the jets suddenly peels away, leaving the other three to fly on in the missing man formation. "I know in my heart that man is good," the inscription on Reagan's tombstone reads, "that what is right will always eventually triumph, and there is purpose and worth to each and every life." Afterword. In March 2015, the Journal of Alzheimer's Disease published a study examining the press conferences of Ronald Reagan's presidency. Researchers were looking for changes in his vocabulary that might have signaled an early onset of dementia. They found three specific symptoms. Reagan's use of repetitive words increased, as did his habit of substituting of "it" or "thing" for specific nouns. Meanwhile, use of unique words declined. The study's authors also noted that trauma and the use of anesthesia can hasten dementia. They specifically mentioned that the 1981 assassination attempt could also have played a pivotal role in Ronald Reagan's decline. The man who shot Reagan, John Hinckley Jr., remains at St. Elizabeth's Hospital in Washington, D.C. to this day, more than 30 years after being found not guilty of attempting to assassinate the president by reason of insanity. Hinckley may not remain in custody much longer. In December 2013, a federal judge declared he was not a danger and authorized unsupervised visits of up to 17 days at his mother's home in Williamsburg, Virginia. Hinckley is allowed to drive a car, but not talk to the media. The judge requires that he carry a GPS-enabled cell phone in order that they can track his movements. In time, he may become a completely free man, following in the footsteps of attempted presidential assassins Squeaky Frome and Sarah Jane Moore, who were released in 2009 and 2007, respectively. Both women served more than three decades in prison for attempting to kill President Gerald Ford. In January 2015, prosecutors declined to press additional murder charges in the August 2014 death of Reagan Press Secretary James Brady, despite the fact that Hinckley's bullets were directly responsible for the wounds that ultimately killed Brady at age 73. Brady never fully recovered from the ordeal, spending the second half of his life dealing with constant pain, slurred speech, paralysis, and short-term memory loss. As a result, his wife Sarah, who sat with Nancy Reagan in the hospital chapel on the day of the assassination attempt, became a ferocious advocate for gun control. Sarah Brady died of pneumonia at the age of 73 in April 2015, less than a year after her husband passed away. Tim McCarthy, the only man in Secret Service history to take a bullet for a president, currently serves as the chief of police in the Chicago suburb of Orland Park. "I'm glad I got to do it," he told the Chicago Tribune in 2011. "I'm glad to do what I was trained to do." District of Columbia policeman Thomas K. Delahanty, Hinckley's final victim, sued the gun manufacturer whose bullet ended his police career. He also sued John Hinckley, though the courts ruled against him in both cases. Delahanty made cameo appearances in two movies about the assassination attempt, but never returned to police work. As of this writing in August 2015, Nancy Reagan still lives in the Bel Air, California home she once shared with Ronald Reagan. The former First Lady, who, in the words of one reporter, rescued the Reagan presidency, laid a wreath on his tomb in 2011 to celebrate the 100th anniversary of his birth. She has endured her own health problems, including a fractured pelvis in 2008 and broken ribs sustained in a fall 4 years later. Yet, while often confined to a wheelchair and in declining health, Nancy Reagan continues to be an advocate for Alzheimer's research. The Reagan children remain in the public eye. Patty Davis once again posed nude, this time for More magazine in 2011 at the age of 58, and continues to make a living as a freelance writer. Ron Reagan Jr. lives in Seattle, where he currently works as an advocate for atheism and for stem cell research. In March 2014, he lost his wife of 33 years, Doria Palmieri Reagan, to a progressive neuromuscular disease. Ron Reagan continues to be a liberal advocate, often appearing on cable news programs. Michael Reagan is a longtime conservative radio talk show host. He called his adoptive half-brother Ron an embarrassment for suggesting in a book that their father suffered from Alzheimer's disease while serving as president. Michael Reagan's life has not been easy, as he has been involved in a variety of civil lawsuits. The only child of Ronald Reagan to attempt a political career, Maureen, died of melanoma in 2001 at the age of 60. She is buried at Calvary Catholic Cemetery in Sacramento. Jodie Foster not only survived the media scrutiny that came with the Reagan assassination attempt, but has thrived. After graduating from Yale in 1985, she went on to a distinguished Hollywood career as an actor, director, and producer. Foster has won 2 Academy Awards for Best Actress, the first in 1989 for her role in The Accused, and the second in 1992 for her signature lead role in The Silence of the Lambs. John Hinckley was reportedly outraged when Jodie Foster came out as a lesbian in 2013. 2013 was also the year Margaret Thatcher died, at age 87. The former British Prime Minister was elevated to Baroness in 1992 and made a member of the House of Lords after a lifetime as a commoner. Her memory began to fail her in 2000, but it was a series of small strokes in 2002 that led her to withdraw from public life. Her taping of Ronald Reagan's eulogy was the last public speech she ever gave. The ashes of Margaret Hilda Thatcher are interred on the grounds of the Royal Hospital Chelsea in London, next to those of her husband Dennis, who died in 2003. James Baker III, Ronald Reagan's chief of staff during his first term in office, is still active as a political advisor at the age of 85, as is his fellow member of the Reagan Troika, Edwin Meese. At age 83, Meese lives in Virginia, where he serves on a number of educational boards and public policy think tanks. Reagan's third advisor, Michael Deaver, fell prey to pancreatic cancer on August 18, 2007. Deaver left the Reagan White House after the first term, opening a successful Washington lobbying agency. On March 18, 1987, he was convicted of 5 counts of perjury during an investigation into his use of insider influence and power with his new firm. His crime was perjuring himself to Congress and a federal grand jury. For that, Deaver was sentenced to 3 years probation and fined $100,000. Despite Deaver's request, Ronald Reagan did not extend the offer of a pardon before leaving office. Nancy Reagan did not attend Deaver's funeral, but issued a statement stating that Deaver was like a son. Michael Deaver was 69 years old when he passed away. Nancy's feelings were obviously not as warm toward Don Reagan. After the White House chief was fired because of her, Reagan turned to landscape painting as a way to pass his days. He was content in his artistic endeavors, often spending as much as 10 hours a day painting. Don Regan died of cancer on June 10, 2003. He is buried in Arlington National Cemetery. Ronald Reagan's first wife, Jane Wyman, lived to be 90 years old. After divorcing Reagan, Wyman went on to have one more husband, bandleader Fred Karger, whom she married and divorced twice. By the time of her death in 2007, she had become such a devout Catholic that she was laid to rest in the habit of the Dominican Sisters Religious Order. Jane Wyman is buried in Forest Lawn Cemetery in Los Angeles, California. Ronald Reagan's mother, Nell Reagan, died on July 25, 1962. She was 79 years old. Her husband, the hard-drinking Jack Reagan, had died in 1941 at age 57. Both are buried at the Calvary Cemetery in East Los Angeles. Ronald Reagan's lone sibling, his older brother Neil, died in 1996 of heart failure. His body was cremated. Ronald Reagan's beloved Rancho del Cielo was sold in 1998, but the property has not been developed or subdivided, nor has the white adobe ranch house been torn down. Rather, the property remains exactly as it was during the time Ronald and Nancy Reagan owned it. A conservative group known as the Young Americas Foundation purchased the land from Nancy Reagan, who lowered her asking price significantly to make the sale possible. A museum in Santa Barbara, California, recounts the history of the ranch, while also displaying a number of items of Reagan memorabilia. There are a limited number of tours of the property, allowing visitors to comprehend firsthand exactly why Ronald Reagan knew such contentment at this mountaintop retreat. To this day, there are those who contend that the ghost of Ronald Reagan is present on the property.
Last word. In researching and writing this book, Martin Dugard and I were extremely careful to use only material we could confirm through at least two sources, and even then we tried to be very fair in presenting facts that might put certain individuals in a bad light. In the last year of his presidency, Ronald Reagan was aware that some close to him were questioning the way he was running his administration. Critical books by daughter Patty, Donald Regan, former spokesman Larry Speaks, and others apparently wounded Reagan, who valued loyalty. The president, however, kept his own counsel, rarely saying anything. On May 16, 1988, he finally let loose in a private letter to his friend and advisor, John Kohler. That letter is now owned by me. And it says, in no uncertain terms, that Nancy Reagan did not have anything to do with any firings at the White House, and Ronald Wilson Reagan did not use astrologers in any way at all that affected public policy.
This is Robert Petkoff. We hope you have enjoyed this production of Killing Reagan, The Violent Assault That Changed a Presidency, by Bill O'Reilly and Martin Dugard. This program was produced and directed by Laura Wilson. Recorded by Matty Argyropoulos at Merlin Studios in New York City. Post-production by Danny Meltzer. Text copyright 2015 by Bill O'Reilly and Martin Dugard. Production copyright 2015, Macmillan Audio. All rights reserved.